out indebted renters expires. The U.S. Supreme Court allowed the 11-month-old moratorium to stay in place last month, but ruled that any further extension would require congressional approval. The Republicans in the House of Representatives, however, blocked the Democratic-led efforts to extend the eviction ban through mid-October. The House will now go to recess for summer vacation. This comes as over 11 million adult Americans are behind on their rent amid COVID-19 restrictions. The pandemic has so far infected nearly 35 million people in the U.S. and killed over 613,000 Americans. Our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, joined us with a rundown of why the eviction ban was not extended.
Yeah, well, first we have to remember that we live in a capitalist society in America. So you have many businesses that are losing money because of the fact that people cannot pay their rent. They're not paying into the system. So that means rent, that means mortgages. So even if those are on delay because of COVID, because of extenuating circumstances, the bottom line is that businesses are not getting the financial means that they need to stay viable for. And so Congress, of course, being the neoliberalist and capitalist influenced entity that it is, has talked about eliminating that moratorium so businesses can start getting paid, because therefore they believe that doing this will help to at least improve a lag in the economy. It seems that it's on the upswing. They want to make it more robust. And that's one of the things that they're very focused on right now. Even if people are struggling to pay their rent, because they may not be back to work, or in fact, they may be back to work and not getting the money that they should be getting, the fact is that the bottom line is that businesses aren't getting the money that they're supposed to be getting. So Congress is ruling almost against the people to try to stimulate the economy and get the United States back to where it was before COVID took its hold in strangulating the economy and making sure that people were restricted in the financial improvement that they were experiencing before the pandemic took hold.
Moving on, Indonesian officials say 1,800 COVID-19 patients lost their lives in the past day, the world's highest death toll on Saturday. The country has become the new COVID-19 epicenter in Asia, with a record infections and deaths this month. Officials blame the surge on the Delta variant, which is more contagious and deadlier than its original virus. Vietnam is also facing a rise in infections with a total of 145,000 cases. The government has extended strict lockdown measures in Ho Chi Minh, as well as another 18 cities and provinces, for 2 more weeks to help combat its worst COVID outbreak. Infectious disease specialist Gloria Taliani says vaccination should be the main tool to prevent the development of the new coronavirus variants.
Lockdown is a measure we have used when we didn't have any other opportunity and any other tool to contrast the circulation of the virus. It seems to be a little bit outdated, because now we have the vaccine, and vaccination should be the main target and the main tool to constrain the virus. It sounds really strange to use lockdown in a period when we could use properly and efficiently the vaccine as a containment measure to reduce not only the circulation, which is also a target of vaccination, but mostly the development of severe disease and the occurrence of death. When we didn't have any other way of contrasting the spread of the virus, in that time, of course, lockdown was the only useful measure. But at the moment, we should employ and we should enlarge the use of vaccine.
In France, the Yellow Vest movement has taken to the streets again in many cities to protest, especially against the way the French government organizes a vaccination campaign. Our correspondent in Paris has more.
We are all against the health pass. That was the main slogan that brought together many protesters all over France. For the third week in a row, they continued marching against the government's decision to put in place a health pass for all citizens. This is an electronic document that every citizen has to show in public places that proves that they are vaccinated or have a negative PCR test. Medical figures are crystal clear. In European countries where the majority of its population is vaccinated, like the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark or Ireland, the COVID virus and its Delta variant are under control. So why are these protesters taking the street again?
I am in favor of the vaccination. Not for this one, because we have not enough information about this vaccine. So I am in favor of the vaccination, but I am against the health path. We have our liberties and no one should tell us what we should do or not.
In hospitals, doctors say that the new wave of people with severe COVID symptoms are all non-vaccinated persons. In Martinique and La Réunion, two overseas French territories, a new lockdown has begun, given that very few people are vaccinated. The vaccination campaign has accelerated the last 3 weeks. In France now, more than 50% have received two jabs of the vaccine. So is it responsible to protest against these mandatory measures?
All this science will tell us, and science needs time to be proven efficient. So we need more time to see what's really happening.
I am not against the vaccine itself. I am more against the health pass and the political use of it. If the government had given sufficient means to health workers and hospitals to handle the COVID crisis, it would have been more efficient.
3,000 police officers have been mobilized to control all the marches today in the French capital. There were some clashes. It's amazing to see so many protesters on the street at the start of the holiday season. Some say that with these protests against the authoritarian measures of the French government, the Yellow Vest movement rose from its ashes. Despite clear indications that vaccination is effective in reducing symptomatic cases and deaths from COVID-19, protests continue in France, but rather against a mandatory health pass considered as a violation of individual liberties rather than against the vaccination itself. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. Now, in this edition, fighting rages between government and Taliban forces on the outskirts of three major cities in southern and western Afghanistan. Officials and residents reported that Taliban militants have entered parts of Herat, Lashkar Gah, and Kandahar, seeking to seize cities from the government forces. In Herat, hundreds of people have fled their homes to seek shelter closer to the heart of the city. This a day after the militants attacked the main UN compound in Herat on Friday, killing a security guard. The Taliban launched a widespread offensive across the country in early May. The militants control about half of Afghanistan's districts, including the border crossing with Iran and Afghanistan. To discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Mike Harris, editor of Veterans Today, joining us live from Phoenix, and also Mr. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer from Westchester University. Now, let's begin with Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris, could you see this coming?
Absolutely. This was a very, very predictable outcome for the U.S. vacating Afghanistan. We witnessed the same thing happen back in Vietnam during the fall of Saigon. This was absolutely foreseeable. It was predictable. And the U.S. really mishandled this. The Biden administration did an awful job on this one. They should have set up some sort of a council for reconciliation in order to bring the two sides together, air the grievances that each has against each other. But the Afghan people, and the Taliban in particular, are fed up with the occupation government that was imposed on them for the last 20 years by the U.S. government. And so they're fighting very vigorously to expel any remaining elements of that occupational government.
Thank you very much. Mr. Davidson, in what way do you think the Biden administration could have helped the situation not get so much out of hand?
I don't think that reconciliation was possible at this point, actually. Not that it wouldn't have been worthwhile to do that, but I think this is inevitable. This whole, the whole episode as it's closing down. As your other guest said, it's what happens when you lose a war. I mean, you're an occupying force, you're there supporting a rather unpopular government, and you're losing the war. So just like in Vietnam, you're going to have to evacuate the place at a certain point. Whether Biden was timely on this or not, at some point you would have to, the Americans are going to have to come out, and they will take with them at least a small number of Afghans who chose to support them. But this was predictable. It was predictable years ago. And quite frankly, I don't think the American people actually know at this point, and for a while, why we're there at all.
That's a good question, actually. Mr. Harris, do you think it was a good idea for the U.S. to go into Afghanistan in the first place?
Absolutely not. First of all, most people in the U.S. realize that the lie that was told about 9/11 and the involvement that Afghanistan had is an utter fabrication. And so the justification for going into Afghanistan and into Iraq was based on a lie. It promoted other foreign policy interests for the U.S. and for Israel. There was a lot to do. They hoped to prop up the military-industrial complex by creating an ongoing war, an ongoing permanent enemy here with the Islamic people in order to fund these outrageous and bloated military budgets. And this has just been a travesty and a crime not just against the Afghan people, but against the American people as well. Before Afghanistan, the U.S. did not have an opioid problem. Under the Taliban, prior to the U.S. invasion, opium production was a mere 250 tons a year. Under the U.S. occupational government, went up to 9,400 metric tons per year. So they created a tremendous cash machine there that generated cash to fund their black programs globally. So the U.S. was reluctant to give that up and to give up that cash flow. There was a lot of incentive to stay there, not just from the military-industrial complex making profits, the Raytheons, the Northrop Grummans, the General Dynamics, all of those, but also from the big pharma. The Sackler family with Purdue made billions of dollars off of the opioid crisis. And there's just too many incentives, too much money was being made by the wealthy elites in the U.S. to abandon it. And it really, really cost the American people in a multitude of ways. This was really a crime by our government against the American people by allowing this opioid problem to come into this country. Again, another betrayal of the American people by our government.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davidson. Do you believe that the situation in Afghanistan could spiral out of control?
No, I don't know what you mean by spiral out of control. I mean, there's going to be an ongoing effort on the Taliban, successful in the end, to take over Afghanistan completely. And if they can prevent sort of intra-war within their own ranks and set up a central government, then it won't spiral out of control. I actually agree with 90% of what your other guests have said. And the only thing I don't particularly agree with is the notion that the American people actually know that they were lied to. The lie was... It is a very effective propaganda effort, and it's always been that way. Certainly since Vietnam, we've been able to lie to the American people almost with impunity in ways that get us involved abroad. And I don't see that very many people actually understand this, and certainly they don't rebel against it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mike Harris, editor of Veterans Today out of Phoenix, and Mr. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer from Westchester University. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us, and thanks to all of our for following this edition of the News Review. Mm-hmm. Moving on, militants in the Central African Republic have attacked a village in the country's northeast, killing at least 6 civilians and wounding several others. The spokesman for the UN peacekeeping mission in the country said gunmen from the 3R group launched a large-scale attack against army positions in the village of Man. He said that the situation is currently under control and patrols are underway. The 3R is a rebel group composed of members from the Fanali ethnic group, one of the several such outfits flourishing in the violence-wrecked country. The Central African Republic is still suffering from the aftermath of a civil war that erupted in 2013. And wildfires in Turkey are wreaking havoc across the country's southern coastal regions. Authorities say the death toll from the infernos has risen to 6 people, 2 of them firefighters. Also, over 200 people have been injured and hundreds of homes charred to the ground. Dozens of villages and some hotels were evacuated in high-risk areas. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has expressed solidarity with the victims. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The window to avoid climate catastrophe is closing with every passing day. Britons are in the decisive decade in this fight, and they must treat the climate crisis as an issue that stands alone in the combination of its urgency and the shadow it casts over future generations. We now present you an article written by Ed Miliband, the Labour MP for Doncaster North and Shadow Business, Energy and Industry Secretary. The piece is titled "Britain's Biggest Enemy is No Longer Climate Denial, but Climate Delay." Future generations will look back on the climate events of 2021 and say that was the year Britons ran out of excuses. Heat waves and flooding in the United Kingdom, temperatures topping 50 degrees Celsius in Pakistan, hundreds killed by a heat wave in British Columbia in Western Canada, deadly floods in Germany and China, all within a single month. Add to that the recent dire warning from the Met Office that the age of extreme weather has just begun. The wake-up call that this offers is not just the obvious one. that climate breakdown is already in the United Kingdom, it also illustrates that British people in this generation are in a unique position in the history of this crisis. Climate breakdown can no longer be plausibly denied as a threat etched only in the future. And all too soon, avoiding it may be a luxury lost to the past. The window to avoid catastrophe is closing with every passing day. Britons are in the decisive decade in this fight, and they must treat the climate crisis as an issue that stands alone in the combination of its urgency and the shadow that it casts over all future generations. The actions we take defy the normal rhythm of political cycles. What we do in the next few years will have effects for hundreds of years to come. Unless the world cuts emissions in half in this decade, we will probably lose the chance to avoid warming of significantly more than 1.5 degrees Celsius set out in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. We have seen the catastrophic effects of a world warmed by just 1.2 degrees Celsius. What happens if we get to 2.5 degrees Celsius or even 3 degrees Celsius? By then, we look back at recent summers as not the hottest we've ever had, but in all likelihood, the coolest we will ever have again. The accompanying truth is that our biggest enemy is no longer climate denial, but climate delay. The most dangerous opponents of change are no longer the shrinking minority who deny the need for action, but the supposed supporters of change who refuse to act at the pace the science demands. As Bill McKibben, environmentalist and climate scholar, says on climate, winning slowly is the same as losing. Ed Miliband, the Labour MP for Doncaster North, says, the UK government is a case in point. There is a chasm between the boosterish rhetoric of Boris Johnson government and reality. We are way off meeting our climate targets, which are themselves insufficiently ambitious, graded somewhere below 4 out of 10 for delivery by the Climate Change Committee. Nothing is more dangerous than the mirage of action shrouding the truth of inaction, because it breeds either false confidence that we will be okay or cynicism and despair about meaningless political promises. But why are they failing? Above all, because of a dogged refusal to put government investment at a scale behind a green recovery. The more government refuses to provide the proper plan and finance, the harder decisions on boilers, cars and industrial transition become. A government that absents its responsibility for making these transitions is a government that will fail to make them happen. This is not simply failing to protect Britons from the biggest long-term threat they face. It's economically illiterate too. The case for investing now is not just clear as a question of intergenerational equity, is also the only conclusion to draw from a hard-headed fiscal analysis of the costs and benefits. The Office for Budget Responsibility tells the British people that the costs of acting early are surprisingly small relative to their national income. In the central scenario, an average annual investment in net terms of just 0.4% of gross domestic product GDP between now and 2050. Meanwhile, we know that inaction is entirely unaffordable, leaving massive costs of climate damage racked up and left for future generations. The Office for Budget Responsibility also tells us that delay will significantly raise the cost of action, in part because we're baking high carbon into our infrastructure. We will have to make the transition at some point. Failing to act now will betray our children and our grandchildren, and will just end up costing more. We should act now, not just because we must avoid future generations living in a disaster movie, but because rewriting the script can produce a better world. Rapid decarbonization is the imperative, but we can do so in a way that fixes the inequalities that exist in our current economic system. This is the promise of the Green New Deal. That is, transformative program of investment can also generate good jobs, help existing industries transition and create new ones, ensure warmer homes, cleaner air, and a lasting shift in wealth and power across our country. This is the vision that we must fight for. Particularly in this year of all years, what we do here at home has a real impact around the world. If other governments believe that a country that has purportedly led the way on climate is full of hot air, it simply undermines trust and lets the big polluters off the hook. In the less than 100 days left to COP26 summit in Glasgow, the Prime Minister must finally wake up to the fact that this is not a glorified international photo opportunity, but a complex and fragile negotiation where he must deliver at home and engage in the hard yards of diplomacy. Just over 50 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. said of the fight for racial and economic justice, "We're now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In the unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. As the generation that stands astride the causes and consequences of this climate emergency, we must take heed of those words."
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints,
the presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
What I would like to ask to both of you is actually a question that's been on my mind, and I'm sure it's on a lot of people's minds. We spoke previously about the resistance front in terms of the media. Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam, these are predominantly projecting the idea of the Islamic Revolution and revolutionary ideals. However, there were other channels as well, which at least apparently they didn't have anything to do with the revolution. There were other channels as well which didn't seem to be projecting as much the revolutionary ethos, and yet they were blocked. It does feel like a calculated attack against Shiaism collectively. So why is my question, actually? And I'd like to go to whoever. I think I'll go to Sayyid Mahdi first.
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So here, just a little bit of a quick background. These are 33 channels in total which have been blocked. They have been censored, or in these very, you know, lame terms, they're calling it a seizure, so that it doesn't sound like censorship, but it is really, it is the censorship of free speech and the censorship of media. It is the censorship of ideas. There are 33 total channels that have been censored, that have been seized, they have been blocked, which include channels which are related to Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani. It includes a Bahraini channel, which is an opposition channel based in for Bahrain. It includes, of course, Press TV. It includes Arabic language. Now, Press TV is news. Al-Alam is news. Al-Masira is also news, which is from Yemen. And then there's, like I said, there's a total of 33. So what's interesting is you find that a lot of these are news channels. Press TV, you can't really call it a Shia channel. Al Alam is not a Shia channel. Al Masira is not necessarily.
They're news channels, right?
They're news channels. Like, they're just like, it's like if tomorrow the, the Chinese Communist Party wanted to block CNN and BBC and RT and Associated Press. I mean, the world would go wild. They would say, who has given you the right to block a news channel, you know? So this kind of censorship, first of all, we talked in a previous
program. If you allow me, there's a common denominator, right? Yeah. And that common denominator is that any channel who is one way or the other, loosely or strictly tied to, or in their calculation, in their research, their means, you know, FBI and the Homeland Security and so on and so forth, if in their calculation it's tied to the Islamic Republic of Iran, they get to pay the penalty, right? They are going to be blocked. That's a clear message that they send out by blocking some of those channels which are not so pro-revolution and so on and so forth. They wanted to give a clear message that if you even think of going down that route, you're going to be blocked.
I have a follow-up question.
So, for example, now where is this coming from? One of the things that we talked in a previous program was this: that they are vulnerable, right? They're vulnerable. They feel fragile. The West does. This is why they did this very radical and extreme thing, you know? And they're vulnerable because they have realized that they're weak, right? You don't feel vulnerable if you feel that you're strong.
Mm-hmm. And they feel weak because their narrative is weak.
Their narrative is weak, and that's what's happening, is all of a sudden the Western world can no longer defend their ideals, you know, in this so-called offense. Really, it's the defense of this you know, non-mass media, this mainstream mass media, right? So whether it's Press TV or Al Masira or these guys, they are no longer able to defend themselves. They are no longer able to, the Western media is no longer able to promote the falsehood and really protect the falsehood that is coming out with when it is faced with the truth and this alternate media that's coming out with these things. And they're afraid that the reality will come out. My final thing here is that this seizure and this censorship of these media outlets is in fact a colossal and manifest admittance of the failure of not just Western media, but their whole system and their whole propaganda empire. And it's interesting, ending with Imam Ali Khamenei, right, the leader of the Muslim Ummah, he says that the Western Zionist media empire can be defeated, and this is what you're seeing, the present day defeat of the Western media empire. Don't let the seizure of a few media channels make you believe that they are in control.
There is something very beautiful and benign about the revolution, and anybody who has the Islamic revolution inculcated into their own ethos, whether to a lesser or greater extent.
Right.
And one of the aspects of that is this idea of unity, which everybody on an Islamic level or a non-Islamic level, just humanity, can understand the importance, the beauty of the concept of unity. In our context, we often talk about this in terms of the Sunni Shia schools of thought within Islam. There's at least one channel on that list that I know of which not only did not adhere to the revolutionary standards, it also went against the idea of unity. And so if I was the enemy, just trying to put myself into the Western imperialists' shoes for a moment, it would make more sense to block all those associated to the revolution and leave the rest. Why have they blocked those as well?
Well, like I pointed out before, that sometimes, you know, you want to give a stronger message to your opposition, right? So what you do is you go that extra mile as well, right? So there are some other Shia, quote-unquote, media outlets that have not been blocked. And some of them are allegedly on the payroll of MI6, mm-hmm. right? And we know that. Some others, you know, they were, I feel, one of the dimensions that I can think of is that it's a clear message. You want to be wearing, you know, the libas and the dress of Prophet. You want to be representing Shia Islam. You, this is a message to everyone who wants to do this. Don't even dare to affiliate yourselves with Iran. So this is like a preemptive sort of a thing. You give a message. Because sometimes when somebody decides that I'm going to do this, I'm going to be part of the resistance bloc, it's already too late for you to give them a message. Right? By blocking these channels, you do a preemptive. You take a mm-hmm. preemptive strike. So those who are maybe thinking that, okay, let's change the direction because the tide is changing in support of the camp of resistance overall. So let's kind of, you know, squeeze in. Up until now, we have not. Maybe there were those plans. And because of those plans, they had to pay the price, or it was a preemptive.
And to add here, because if you read a few of these articles, it's interesting. The amount of, right, the Mossad has this statement where they say, through deception, we will conquer, or something like that. They have a certain motto that's like that, right? Meaning that one of their main tactics is smoke and mirrors, deception, falsehood, lies, you know, all this kind of crazy stuff. And so here you will find certain news outlets saying that this inclusion of non-revolutionary websites was somehow a mistake committed by the Justice Department, and they didn't do their research. I mean, come on, you have to be like totally naive to believe that a system that spends millions and millions of dollars on research and analysis, and they know who is doing what, right? There is a reason, and the reason which, you know, Sheikh Ali brought up for it, there is a reason why they have included these non-revolutionary websites, as
and
he off, said,
off
is sending
top of
a strong.
My mind,
they're doing it on purpose.
Another, yeah, there's another dimension to it. It could be that they wanted them to do certain things, let's say, and they denied, because those platforms are primarily running out of UK, if you notice,
mm-hmm.
the ones we're talking about, right? They're denied, maybe. They're like, we don't want to get into this, right? So maybe they're getting punished. We don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing could be that they may unblock them and unseize them. This seizure is going to be lifted
mm-hmm.
As a result of some sort of a deal that they crack in future, maybe in a week or 10 days or 2 weeks. I don't know. Just saying that when you come to politics and when you come to the world, you know, politics and dynamics, these are complex decisions. They're not normally based on just one point agenda. You know, it's these decisions are multidimensional, multi-layered, generally speaking.
Right.
So there could be lots of reasons I can think of.
I want to add,
is there no possibility that they did it out of a blunder?
Because no, there's no possibility.
I doubt
at all,
this is
man.
This is a very childish and naive.
They're spending way too much money to be able to make these kind of silly mistakes.
And it's right in your face. It's not like something you have to go and dig. Right? It's right in your face. It's there. You're watching it. You watch their transmission for a week. So all you need is like a 9-to-5 guy, you know, on your payroll. Just sit there, you know, watch. And when you see these words, you know, just put it on a piece of paper. Very rogue, very simple.
They have computers that can just do that now.
Yeah, I wanted to add something just before the program ends. And that is my own personal humble opinion is that we should be very, very careful. And this is a warning to the whole world, right? The first part is that the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has openly declared that the United States of America is spiraling downwards towards a crash. It has already begun. He said a similar thing about the Zionist regime, that the downfall of the Zionist regime has begun and it will continue to spiral downwards until it crashes. He has said the same thing about America. This is what we're seeing. If you put all the connections together, whether it's Trump, still so many months later, still saying that the elections are rigged. And, for example, the recent attack on the Hashd al-Shaabi on the border of Iraq and Syria, which the American Congress has said is a very inflammatory and something that Biden should have not done, right? And then the seizure of websites. Which is the seizure of freedom of speech, the seizure of opinion, the seizure of ideas. The United States of America is starting to act like a maniac, and it is becoming a very serious threat to the stability of the entire world.
I mean, it already was, but now it's...
No, but now it's just blatant, right? Mm. I have never heard that the United States ever seized somebody else's news media outlets. You know, I mean, this is just crazy. And now you're attacking countries left and right. You're closing down websites and you're sanctioning people for multiple decades. It's really, just like the Zionist regime is a very serious threat to the West Asian region, the United States of America is becoming a very serious threat to the entire world.
And actually, that's a good point. Let the record show that this happened during Biden's administration, because if this kind of thing had happened during Trump's time, everybody would be like, well,
was mentally,
you know,
prepared, right?
Yeah, Trump is good. It's Trump is Trump, right? Crazy. But no, this is Biden doing this. So, again, is this not a mistake on their part in the sense that this is going to create more
totally. It's going
curiosity,
to backfire.
Right?
Oh, you have no clue. You know, we're already looking at these even secular chat media outlets. You know, I'm not going to name them, but, you know, I've been following them. People who have nothing to do with Islam or Shia Islam or Iran, you know, they're taking a notice of it in that free world. There is such a big opposition of what the United States has done. It has actually, if you notice, this action of the United States of America has endorsed what we have been saying for years, that they silence the word of logic, they silence the word of truth. Anything they don't like, they silence, right? Anything that does not chime with their own agenda, they silence. We've been saying it. Sometimes it was a bit tricky to prove it. Now it's right in your face. Now you don't need to prove it, right? It has backfired big time, and you'll see. Every time they have tried to suppress the innocent people and oppressed people of the world, it actually sooner or later backfired for them, right? Yeah. I've got so many of those examples which you don't have time for. Yeah. Same thing is going to happen in cyber world and in electronic media world now. They're suppressing, they're silencing it. You know, somebody who was doing it half-heartedly, now they're going to do it with more passion because it's already proven to them that they were doing it right.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parsetoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars, the moon. I join them all in praising you. Allah, 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 Allah. I feel alive and I feel so good. I feel so close to you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Key questions remain about how quickly B1617 variants can spread, their potential to evade immunity, and how they might affect the course of the pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by David Adam, researcher. This article is published under the heading, What Scientists Know About New Fast-Spreading Coronavirus Variants. Stay tuned for more. Since the SARS-CoV-2 variant known as B1617 was first reported in India late last year, it has spread to dozens of other countries, including the United States, Singapore, and the UK, where it has become dominant in some regions. Researchers have since identified three subtypes known as B1617-1, the original B1617, B1617-2 and B1617-3, each with a slightly different genetic makeup. They are now rushing to investigate these variants and work out how they might affect the trajectory of the pandemic in countries where they have gained a foothold. Key questions remain about how quickly the variants can spread, their potential to evade immunity, and whether they cause more severe disease. A lot of this research takes the form of standard epidemiology, confirming COVID-19 cases through testing, identifying the variants responsible for infections, and cross-referencing these data to people's clinical symptoms and vaccination statuses. Scientists can also glean insights from genomic sequencing data, identifying which mutations are present in the B1617 subtypes and comparing these with mutations in earlier variants whose behavior is better understood. I look at individual mutations because they each have individual properties that we think might confer higher transmissibility, says Julian Tung, a consultant virologist at the Leicester Royal Infirmary. UK increased transmissibility, a measure of how quickly variants can spread from person to person, could accelerate outbreaks, which could put more pressure on healthcare systems and countermeasures such as vaccination programs. For example, the B1617.2 variant has mutations called 452R and 478K, which Tang says are both linked to increased transmissibility. Both mutations alter the spike protein, which the virus uses to enter human cells. Researchers have also been able to rapidly track the spread of B1617.2 because its genome contains a marker that the dominant B1117 variant lacks. The presence of this marker, known as the S gene target, can be seen in the results of some of the PCR tests used to confirm cases of COVID-19. So, researchers can use positive S target hits as a proxy to quickly map the spread of B1617.2 without needing to sequence samples fully. Both S-gene tests and more detailed sequencing data from UK virus samples indicate that B1617.2 is out-competing the two other B1617 subtypes and replacing B117, a variant identified in Southeast England in late 2020, as the most common variant driving new infections in the country. Across all of England now, we would expect that 50% of infections would be the B1617.2 variant, says Tom Wensler, the biologist at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, who is tracking the figures. An analysis of UK sequencing data that he shared online suggests that numbers of B1617.2 infections could be growing 13% faster than B117 infections each day. In a report published on May 12th, a UK government advisory committee called the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Modelling Operational Subgroup said there is a realistic possibility that B1617.2 is 50% more transmissible than B117 according to the available data. The prediction of 50% more transmissible sounds entirely plausible, says Sharon Peacock, a microbiologist at the University of Cambridge, UK, who leads the COVID-19 Genomics UK Consortium. I think as data goes up more, we will get more confidence in that. But you can't really ignore what's happening. At present, Peacock adds, the surge in B1617.2 is not leading to a significant rise in the overall number of cases in the UK, which remain much lower than during the country's most recent peak in January. Instead, people are catching the new variant rather than B117. What we are seeing here is lineage replacement, she says. Another question researchers are keen to resolve is whether vaccines will remain effective against the B1617 variants, if any of these strains can evade an immune protection conferred by the vaccination or by previous exposure to the virus. They could trigger significant new waves of infection, derail plans to relax lockdowns and other restrictions. In theory, the accelerated spread of B1617.2 in the UK, where more than 50% of the population has received at least one dose of COVID vaccine, could indicate an ability to escape vaccine protection. But Wensler says there is little evidence that vaccine escape is driving the increase in cases. Preliminary data from Bolton, an outbreak hotspot in northwest England from Midway, showed most people who were hospitalized with COVID-19 caused by B1617.2 had not been vaccinated. Some 5 out of 18 hospitalized people testing positive for the variant had received a single vaccine dose, and just one had been given both doses. Separate data analyzed by Wensler showed that infections with the B1617.2 variant in northwest England were initially clustered in teenagers who are not routinely vaccinated. Although the variant subsequently spread to people in their 30s and 40s, those in their 50s who are most likely to have had both vaccine doses experience lower rates of infection. This is reassuring, he says. Genetic sequencing data suggests that the rapid spread of B1.617.2 is less likely to pose a problem to vaccination efforts than spread of B1.617.1. The 452R and 478K mutations identified in B1.617.2 are both linked to vaccine escape, as well as increased transmissibility, says Tong. But B1.617.1 also carries a different mutation called 484Q, which is more strongly associated with vaccine escape. This mutation isn't found in B1.617.2. Some key uncertainties remain, including how much more transmissible B1.617.2 is than other variants, such as the B117 variant now established in the UK and many other countries. It's plausible that it could be 50% greater, but it could also be 10% greater or 60 to 70% greater, says Christina Pagel, a healthcare researcher at the University College London. Establishing this will allow scientists to build more accurate models of the effects of the variants could have on outbreaks in countries where they are becoming dominant, including the UK. It makes a massive difference in terms of what will happen in the summer, says Pagel. The difference from 20% to 50% is like the difference between a moderate wave and a January-style surge, so that really needs pinning down.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. These are the top stories. Millions of Americans face the risk of becoming homeless as a nationwide ban on evictions expires. Rebels kill 6 civilians and wound several others in an attack on a village in the northeast of the Central African Republic. Also on the headlines, the Turkish president vows to punish the perpetrators if it turns out that wildfires in southern Turkey were sparked by arson